Another story tells of the time he stayed in Franklin, where he boarded at the Exchange Hotel and liked to have bread and milk for supper. Occasionally, he donned a dingy old suit to help his men load barrels. One Sunday, an employee came rushing in to tell Rockefeller that the river was rising dangerously and might sweep away their barrels. Rockefeller, preparing for church, put on his hat with aplomb, said he had to go to prayer, and refused to attend to business. Perhaps Rockefeller really did have God on his side, for his barrels survived the flooding intact. Drilling for oil often seemed less an industry than a lottery. Nobody knew if oil would provide a lasting benefit to mankind or an evanescent wonder. If the oil regions created many millionaires, they left many more paupers. Instead of building up an industry, most producers preferred to drain their wells as quickly as possible in this harum-scarum atmosphere. Under the so-called rule of capture, people could drill diagonally and siphon off a neighbor's oil, adding to their haste to pump. Rockefeller succeeded because he believed in the long-term prospects of the business and never treated it as a mirage that would soon fade. Rockefeller's first visit to Pennsylvania must also have persuaded him that he had picked the right entry point to the business. Searching for oil was wildly unpredictable, whereas refining seemed safe and methodical by comparison. Before too long, he realized that refining was the critical point where he could exert maximum leverage over the industry. John D. Rockefeller had an unfailing knack for knowing who would help or hinder him in his career, an instinct only sharpened by time. Sensitive to patronizing behavior, he bridled when anyone tried to lord it over him, and he wanted to be dealt with as a peer even by senior men. Recoiling at what he saw as the Clark brothers' pomposity, he eventually grew as censorious of them as he had been of George Gardner. The Clarks were the first of many business partners to underrate the audacity of the quietly calculating Rockefeller, who bided his time as he figured out how to get rid of them. All along, cross-currents had ruffled his relationship with Morris B. Clark, whom he dismissed as an ignorant, conceited Englishman. A tall, bluff man with a fiery temper and shadowy past, Clark had started out as a gardener in his native Wiltshire, chafing under a tyrannical boss. One day in 1847, he reared up and flattened the man. Fearing arrest, he fled to Boston as a penniless, uneducated fugitive from justice. He migrated west to Cleveland and worked as a woodchopper and teamster before entering the produce business. More of a free spirit than Rockefeller, Clark smoked, drank, and swore freely in the warehouse, and showed scant religious interest. The personality profile didn't appeal to Rockefeller, who bristled at Clark's profanity, but he praised him as a smart, hustling businessman. Because Rockefeller had such respect for ledgers, Clark, nearly 10 years older, looked down on him as a mere clerk, a rigid, blinkered man without vision. "He did not think I could do anything but keep accounts and look after the finances," said Rockefeller. "You see, it took him a long time to feel that I was no longer a boy." He thought Clark envious of his success in soliciting business on the road, perhaps because this undercut Clark's image of him as an expendable clerk. At first, Rockefeller swallowed his anger and stoically endured this injustice. "He tried almost from the beginning of our partnership to dominate and override me," he said of Clark. A question he asked several times in our discussion of business matters was, "What in the world would you have done without me?" "I bore it in silence. It does no good to dispute with such a man." Rockefeller had no doubt who was contributing the lion's share of business. "I was the one who made the firm's success. I kept the books, looked out for the money." As part of Rockefeller's silent craft and habit of extended premeditation, he never tipped off his adversaries to his plans for revenge, preferring to spring his reprisals on them. The investment in oil refining had brought Morris's brother James into the office, and Rockefeller came to detest him. An ex-prize fighter, James Clark was a powerful, bullying young man, and he tried to intimidate Rockefeller, who responded with great sang-froid and courage. One morning, James burst into his office and started swearing violently at Rockefeller, who put his feet up on the desk with imperturbable poise and showed no sign of upset. A fine actor, he always had masterful control of his facial muscles. When James finished, Rockefeller said evenly, "Now, James, you can knock my head off, but you might as well understand that you can't scare me." This fearless young man couldn't be intimidated. After that confrontation, James Clark didn't rant and bluster as much around Rockefeller, but it was clear that they were incompatible colleagues. As with Morris, Rockefeller quarreled with James about business methods and was dismayed by his devious side deals in oil. When James boasted about swindling a former boss or cheating people on buying trips to Pennsylvania, it must have aroused Rockefeller's innermost suspicions, for he closely audited his partner's expenses. Like Morris, James smarted at Rockefeller's self-righteousness and branded him the Sunday school superintendent. Already contemplating the future, Rockefeller wanted to be surrounded by trustworthy people who could inspire confidence in customers and bankers alike. He drew a characteristic conclusion. The weak, immoral man was also destined to be a poor businessman. We were beginning to prosper, and I felt very uneasy at my name being linked up with these speculators. Later on, the Clarks fully reciprocated this contempt, with James describing Rockefeller's sole contribution to Andrews Clark as that of a financial manipulator, and claiming that in 1863, Rockefeller had cheated him of several thousand dollars. If their differences had been chiefly a clash of personalities, Rockefeller's partnership with Morris Clark might have lasted years, but they had sharply divergent views about oil's future and the desirable pace of expansion. Despite the Civil War, the drills never stopped in Pennsylvania, except when General Lee invaded the state and producers had to defend it. As the export business in kerosene widened, Andrews Clark banked solid profits in refining during every year of the war. Yet prices remained as volatile as the war itself, with the supply-demand equation shifting radically each time a single spouter or gusher came in. Amid the ruthlessly competitive conditions, it was never clear where prices would settle or what constituted a normal price. The price fluctuations in a single year were staggering, veering between 10 cents and $10 a barrel in 1861, and $4 and $12 in 1864. Undeterred by these extreme gyrations, both Rockefeller and Andrews wanted to borrow heavily and expand, while Clark favored a more circumspect approach. What likely clinched Rockefeller's decision to break from the three Clarks was that they had the votes to override him and Andrews and didn't hesitate to use their majority in a high-handed way. In later reminiscences, Rockefeller disclosed an incident that casts light on his relations with the Clarks. "Morris Clark was very angry when I borrowed money to extend our business of refining oil. 'Why, you have borrowed $100,000,' he exclaimed, as if that were some sort of offense." Rockefeller's amazement seems somewhat disingenuous. It was a stupendous sum, but all Rockefeller could see was that Morris Clark lacked his audacity. "Clark was an old grandmother and was scared to death because we owed money at the banks." One can forgive the Clarks if they found something overbearing about this bumptious young man who would risk all their capital, evidently without notifying them. Significantly, the Clarks were irked by both Rockefeller's frugality and his prodigality, his tight-fisted control of details and advocacy of unbridled expansion. Daring in design, cautious in execution, it was a formula he made his own throughout his career. By 1865, Rockefeller, age 25, decided it was time for a showdown with the Clarks. He wasn't the sort to persist in a flawed situation, and he was now prepared to clear away the encumbrances that had thwarted his early career. For Rockefeller, success in the oil business required a bullish, nearly glandular faith in its future. Before deciding to enter the business on a large scale, he needed one last God-given proof that the oil wouldn't disappear. Decisive evidence that came in January 1865 at a place called Pithole Creek. The nearby rocks and chasms had always emitted sulfur gas and attracted the notice of oil men. One day, a group of eccentric producers, waving a witch hazel twig serving as a divining rod, drilled on the spot where the twig dipped down. When a tremendous gusher spouted up days later, another madcap chapter in the oil industry commenced, with speculators, drillers, and business agents converging on the spot. Within a few months, the sleepy frontier settlement with four log cabins was transformed into a hectic little metropolis of 12,000 people. Overnight, 50 hotels sprang up, along with a theater that seated 100 and was lit by crystal chandeliers. So improbable was Pithole's rise that it seemed a phantom city, a conjurer's trick. "It was more than a city," says one chronicler. "It was a state of post-war euphoria. Even by the sordid standards of the oil regions, it was a disreputable place." "Every other shop is a liquor saloon," said one journalist. "It is safe to assert that there is more vile liquor drunk in this town than in any other of its size in the world." One eyewitness to the whole Pithole lunacy was an observant 8-year-old girl named Ida Minerva Tarbell, who lived 10 miles away in Rouseville, and saw hordes of eager men streaking to the boomtown. When her father built an oil tank shop there, he made the fastest money of his life. Unfortunately, Pithole's ebullient heyday was short-lived, and within a few years its wells were exhausted from fire and overproduction. Before the town reverted back to sylvan peace, people began to scavenge for scrap. For $600, Ida Tarbell's father bought the fancy Bonta House Hotel, constructed a few years earlier for $60,000, and carried off its lumber, doors, and windows to erect a home for the Tarbell family in Titusville. By 1874, the moment of its greatness having flickered, Pithole counted just 6 voters. In hindsight, Pithole was a cautionary fable of blasted hopes and counterfeit dreams, renewing fears of the industry's short lifespan. But in January 1865, it suggested that there were many undiscovered pockets of oil, and it probably acted as a catalyst that hastened Rockefeller's break with the Clarks. This parting was vintage Rockefeller. He slowly and secretly laid the groundwork, then moved with electrifying speed to throw his adversaries off balance. That January, Morris Clark had openly fumed when Rockefeller asked him to sign yet another note. "We have been asking too many loans in order to extend this oil business," Clark said. Undaunted, Rockefeller shot back, "We should borrow whenever we can safely extend the business by doing so." Trying to intimidate Rockefeller, the Clark brothers threatened to dissolve the partnership, which required the unanimous consent of all the partners. Determined to break loose from the Clarks and the commission business, Rockefeller sounded out Sam Andrews privately and told him, "Sam, we are prospering. We have a future before us, a big future. But I don't like Jim Clark and his habits. He is an immoral man in more ways than one. He gambles in oil. I don't want this business to be associated with a gambler. Suppose I take them up the next time they threaten a dissolution. Suppose I succeed in buying them out. Will you come in with me?" When Andrews agreed, they shook hands on the deal. A few weeks later, just as Rockefeller expected, he quarreled with Morris Clark, and the latter threatened to dissolve the partnership. "If that's the way you want to do business, we'd better dissolve, and let you run your own affairs to suit yourself," Clark warned. Moving swiftly to implement his scenario, Rockefeller invited the partners to his home on February 1, 1865, and vigorously expounded a policy of rapid refinery expansion, a policy he knew was anathema to the Clarks. Playing right into Rockefeller's hands, James Clark tried to browbeat him. "We'd better split up," he declared. In conformity with the partnership agreement, Rockefeller got everyone to state publicly that he favored dissolution, and the Clarks left imagining they had cowed Rockefeller. In fact, he raced to the office of the Cleveland Leader and placed a notice in the morning paper dissolving the partnership. The next morning, when the Clarks saw it, they were stunned. "Do you really mean it?" an incredulous Morris Clark asked Rockefeller. He hadn't realized before that Rockefeller had lined up Andrews on his side. "You really want to break it up?" "I really want to break it up," replied Rockefeller, who had sounded out sympathetic bankers in the preceding weeks. It was agreed that the firm would be auctioned to the highest bidder. Even as a young man, Rockefeller was extremely composed in a crisis. In this respect, he was a natural leader. The more agitated others became, the calmer he grew. It was an index of his matchless confidence that when the auction occurred, the Clarks brought a lawyer, while Rockefeller represented himself. "I thought that I could take care of so simple a transaction," he boasted. With the Clarks' lawyer acting as auctioneer, the bidding began at $500 and quickly rose to a few thousand dollars, then inched up slowly to about $50,000. Already more than Rockefeller thought the refining business worth. Since this auction was a turning point on his road to industrial supremacy, let us quote his account of the historic moment as he related it in his memoirs. "Finally, it advanced to $60,000, and by slow stages to $70,000, and I almost feared for my ability to buy the business and have the money to pay for it. At last, the other side bid $72,000. Without hesitation, I said $72,500. Mr. Clark then said, 'I'll go no higher, John. The business is yours.' 'Shall I give you a check for it now?' I suggested. 'No,' Mr. Clark said. 'I'm glad to trust you for it. Settle at your convenience.'" Rockefeller knew the moment was fraught with consequences. "It was the day that determined my career. I felt the bigness of it, but I was as calm as I am talking to you now," he told William O. Inglis. He paid a lofty price for his freedom, surrendering to Clark his half-interest in the commission business, along with the $72,500. The purchase price would be equivalent to $652,000 today. Yet he had captured a tremendous prize. At age 25, he had won control of Cleveland's largest refinery, which could treat 500 barrels of crude oil daily, twice the capacity of its nearest local rival, and ranked as one of the world's largest facilities. On February 15, 1865, the Cleveland Leader printed the following item: "Co-partnership notice. The undersigned, having purchased the entire interest of Andrews, Clark & Company in the Excelsior Oil Works, and all the stock of barrels, oil, etc., will continue the business of the late firm under the name of Rockefeller & Andrews." Rockefeller savored his revenge against the Clarks, who were shocked that their junior partner had lined up on the sly financing for such a large deal, and Rockefeller gloated at the older men's complacent naivete. "Then the Clark brothers woke up and saw for the first time that my mind had not been idle while they were talking so big and loud." All of Rockefeller's Baptist contempt for vanity, show, and loose talk is condensed in that single observation. On March 2, 1865, Clark and Rockefeller was also dissolved, and Rockefeller eliminated the three fractious Clark brothers from his life forever. For Rockefeller, the harrowing memory of the Clarks stayed with him, and he talked as if he had survived a nightmare. "The sufferings I went through in those years, the humiliation and the anguish, I have not words to describe. And I ever pointed to the day when I separated myself from them by paying this large bonus as the beginning of the success I have made in my life." It's hard to know whether Rockefeller exaggerated the Clarks' haughtiness, but the important points are that he was proud and sensitive, and that their barbed words reverberated deeply in his mind. Having emerged as his own boss, he would never again feel his advancement blocked by short-sighted, mediocre men. The demise of Clark and Rockefeller unfolded against the waning days of the Civil War. By December 1864, General Sherman had reached Savannah and swung north through the Carolinas. About 2 months after Rockefeller won the refining business, Robert E. Lee surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox Courthouse. As a town that had sheltered many runaway slaves before the war, Cleveland was especially grieved by the subsequent news of Lincoln's assassination. On April 27th, the funeral train brought his body to lie in state for several hours in a special mortuary pavilion, with women in spotless white robes gathering by the railroad tracks to sing choral dirges to the slain president. By this point, the new firm of Rockefeller and Andrews had been installed on the second floor of a brick building on Superior Street, several blocks from the Cuyahoga River, in an office complex known as the Sexton Block. From his new command post, the young entrepreneur could stare out the window and follow the progress of barges drifting by laden with oil barrels from his refinery. Already a mature businessman, he relied on Andrews only as a technician and assumed control of all other aspects of the business. Having discarded several older partners, the young man had no real business mentors, heroes, or role models, and was beholden to no one. John D. Rockefeller was not only self-made but self-invented, and already had unyielding faith in his own judgment. For all his resoluteness as a young businessman, Rockefeller tarried in settling his private life. Yet he had already fathomed his own needs and sought a woman who would be pious and loving, dedicated to the church, and strongly supportive of his career. Because of his easy, affectionate way with his mother, Rockefeller felt comfortable with women, took genuine pleasure in their company, and, unlike the caddish Bill, treated them with respect. During his brief period at Central High School, Rockefeller had befriended two bright literate sisters, Lucy and Laura Celestia Spellman, and taken a special fancy to Laura, or Setty as she was called. Though he still had an awkward manner with girls, the sisters saw a warm, likable side to him. Unlike most other girls at the school, the practical-minded Setty was taking commercial courses to master business principles, and she applauded John in his storied 1855 job search. As a friend of Setty's later noted, she saw that he was ambitious and she thought that he was honest, which probably appealed to her more than anything else. Clearly, she transmitted to John the message that his chances of winning her would be materially enhanced if his economic prospects improved. There seems little doubt that in courting Setty, John was held back by the disparity in their socioeconomic status, which accounts for the 9-year hiatus between their first meeting in high school and their 1864 marriage. The Spellmans were a high-toned people, a blue-ribbon family living in a fine house. A friend of Laura's recalled, "Perhaps Setty wasn't exactly rich and beautiful, but her father was as well off as any of the girls in our class, a member of the Ohio legislature, and somewhat known for his philanthropic work. So, you know how those things are among children. We thought that it was strange for her to rather show a leaning toward Johnny." It's easy to see what drew John to Laura, aside from patent compatibility, for the Spellmans signified the respectability that had so frustratingly eluded his own family. Civic-minded, stirred to action by social injustice, the Spellmans offered more than entree into the local gentry and were a family of genuine substance. Born in Massachusetts, Harvey Buell Spellman, a direct descendant of the Puritans, and Lucy Henry met in Ohio and were married in 1835, giving birth to Laura Celestia on September 9, 1839. When they moved to Akron in 1841, they lived humbly at first, with Mrs. Spellman taking in washing to extend their income. Setty, as a little girl, sometimes yanked a small red wagon around town to deliver laundry. Even when Harvey Spellman opened a dry goods store and amassed considerable wealth, he and Lucy didn't retreat into private pleasures but redoubled their militant reform efforts. As a member of the local Board of Education, Harvey Spellman spearheaded the creation of a progressive public school system, a crusade that propelled him into the Ohio State Legislature in 1849. Also busy in church causes, the Spellmans helped to found a congregational church in Akron. Their religious beliefs buttressed their secular activism, and they were pledged to root out evil as part of both their religious and political agendas. With his broad forehead, tufty brows, and pugnacious beard, Harvey Buell Spellman was a man of burning fundamentalist convictions and apocalyptic musings. He frequently discerned God's hand smiting the American people for their wicked extravagance, and he issued flaming diatribes against demon rum. "The widespread and excessive use of rum is the tinder which inflames the worst passions in human nature, fosters riots, communism, and strikes, promotes ignorance, vice, and crime, and more than any other cause, threatens the stability of our free institutions," he said in 1879. Lucy Henry, his dignified, industrious wife, enjoyed singing hymns and had little time for small talk, though she could be jolly with her daughters. "At any reference to the Bible, to temperance, to education, to the widening sphere of women, her eyes flashed with old-time fire, and her face was aglow with conviction, a preacher said with pardonable hyperbole at her funeral. As an outgrowth of their church involvement, and this was true of many evangelicals after the Second Great Awakening, Harvey and Lucy were uncompromising abolitionists and temperance activists. With their home serving as a station on the Underground Railroad, they shepherded many slaves from Tennessee and Kentucky to freedom. And Sojourner Truth, the former slave, abolitionist, and itinerant preacher, spent several days with them. According to Setti, the only time she ever saw her mother cooking on the Sabbath was to prepare hot meals for slaves in flight to Canada. The Spellmans felt no less ardently about drink. The crusading Mrs. Spellman not only marched in the streets, but stormed the saloons, dropped to her knees in prayer, and pleaded with sinners at the bar stools to mend their ways, while Mr. Spellman carried on a parallel campaign to shut down rum shops. The Spellman's prosperous life in Akron ended in 1851 when Mr. Spellman's business went bankrupt, the casualty of a bank panic. The family then moved to Cleveland, where Mr. Spellman's fortunes revived, but a dark edge of economic uncertainty always shadowed the family. So while the Spellmans occupied a higher social rung than young Rockefeller, they were haunted by the prospect of economic misfortune and inclined to look favorably upon an up-and-coming suitor with a proper Christian pedigree. Setti needed to find a husband who could safeguard her family's security, so it is not surprising that she championed John's career and eagerly coached him to succeed from the start. It is hard to picture a young woman more perfectly suited to John D. Rockefeller's values than the sensible, cheerful Laura Celestia Spellman, who shared his devotion to duty and thrift. They ratified each other's views about the fundamentals of life. 2 months younger than John, Setti was short and slender, with a round face, dark brown eyes, and a wealth of chestnut hair parted down the middle and smoothly pulled back from her forehead. Rockefeller would never have tolerated a noisy woman, and Setti was soft in voice and manner. Like John, though, her mild surface belied an adamantine determination. She was gentle and lovely, but resolute with indomitable will, noted her sister Lucy, better known in the family as Lute. There was a persuasion in her touch as she laid her fingers ever so gently on your arm. Again, like John, her geniality covered a hard core of sustained willpower. She was full of mirth and cheer, yet rather inclined to be grave and reserved, Lute recalled. A paragon of self-control, she never lost her temper and lacked the skittish frivolity of youth. Early on, John and Laura must have spotted each other as kindred souls, especially when it came to religion. Setti so unswervingly performed her duties at church and Sunday school that even her loving sister tactfully suggested that she went to extremes. She was a religieuse. God and church came first with her. She cared little for the social life, so-called, and together she and her husband deepened and expanded their religion to cover and include every phase of life. Even in photos, one notes a Quakerish simplicity to her appearance, her black dress and lace collar evoking her Puritan ancestors. Despite her evangelical beliefs, she never imposed her views on others and preferred to instruct by example. As one high school classmate remembered, she exerted a strong influence upon the rest of us. For one thing, she didn't believe in dancing and theater going because she did not think it was proper for church people to engage in pursuits that she considered worldly. For all that, Laura was no shallow Philistine and had a wide range of interests in art, culture, and society. She played the piano for 3 hours daily and often accompanied John in duets, but she also had a taste for literature and poetry and could be an entertaining conversationalist. An assiduous student, she was the valedictorian of her high school class, and her commencement speech, "I Can Paddle My Own Canoe," was a ringing manifesto of female emancipation. She graduated 7 years after the first historic attempt by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott to organize women in Seneca Falls, New York. From this speech, we can infer something of her adolescent values. We may not tamely submit and suffer ourselves to be led by any person or party, but have a mind of our own, and having once formed a decision, ever abide by it. This credo augured well for a woman destined to be embroiled in her future husband's controversial career. In an outspoken statement of feminist belief, she chided men for depriving women of culture, then hypocritically blaming them for their dependency. But give woman culture, let her thread the many paths of science, allow mathematics and exact thought on all subjects to exert their influence on her mind, and conventions need not trouble about her proper sphere. In 1856, Harvey and Lucy Spellman left Cleveland for Burlington, Iowa. The move evidently reflected renewed business hardships for Mr. Spellman, and they stayed away from Cleveland for 3 years. To alleviate the financial stress, Setti and Lute stayed behind and jointly applied for teaching posts in the Cleveland public schools. 2 years later, as the economic pinch eased, the two sisters spent a year at the Oread Collegiate Institute in Worcester, Massachusetts. Established in 1849, this junior college was among the first institutions of higher learning open to women. Founded by abolitionist Eli Thayer, Oread stressed Christianity and the reading of the classics. Drawings show a picturesque medieval-looking building on a hill, festooned with turrets, towers, and crenellations, and surrounded by a stone wall. The cultural atmosphere, with its impassioned support for women's rights and black welfare, must have been highly congenial to the sisters. Among other speakers, they heard inspirational lectures given by Ralph Waldo Emerson, Wendell Phillips, Henry Ward Beecher, and John Brown. A devotee of the Protestant work ethic, Setti even approved of the school's daily regimen, which was minutely budgeted from wake up at 5:30 a.m. until the lights went out at 9:45 p.m. "I do not call the rules strict, but am pleased with all of them," she informed her former music teacher. At Oread, she dropped an occasional friendly note to Rockefeller, though the relationship was at this point less one of romance than of close camaraderie. Over the years, Laura's growing commitment to religion smothered her literary bent. But at Oread, she was a veritable blue stocking, writing poetry, running the literary society, and editing the campus literary magazine. In a revealing article in the Oread Euphemia, she wrote about three aristocracies then ruling America: an aristocracy of intellect in New England, wealth in the mid-Atlantic states, and blood in the South. In view of later events, her descriptions of Boston's intellectual preeminence or Southern social decadence are less noteworthy than the vitriol she poured on the New York nouveau riche. In this specified portion of our glorious republic, the parvenu lady, with the brain all guiltless of ever having developed an idea, attires herself in habiliments whose caste, but not style, would admit of their being worn in the presence of royalty. After lambasting the dominion of the almighty dollar in the mid-Atlantic aristocracy, she concluded mordantly, "The gigantic intellect of Boston must bow to Wall Street's stocks and bonds." Such Midwestern scorn for Wall Street's moneyed upstarts was certainly consonant with Rockefeller's beliefs. Little did the two know they would one day become synonymous with the almighty dollar and reside in the heart of Manhattan's swankest, most sinful precincts. In the spring of 1859, the Spellman sisters returned to Cleveland and began to take French, Latin, piano, and voice lessons at the Cleveland Institute. That autumn, Setti and Lute, who always moved in tandem, began to teach in the public schools, Setti serving as a teacher and principal's assistant, while Lute taught boys in the same building. Later on, Laura left no doubt of her family's straitened circumstances at the time. "I had to do work, which was a good thing," she later told her son. "And I loved to do it, which was another good thing." Despite a well-merited reputation as a disciplinarian, she was a popular teacher, and on her last day on the job, all the girls in her class remained after dismissal to say goodbye to her and to cry over losing her, said one pupil. My, how they cried. In the early 1860s, Laura was sufficiently pleased with work that she felt in no special rush to get married. All the while, John Rockefeller, with the dogged patience that would defeat scores of embattled competitors, waited determinedly in the wings. In April 1860, Laura wrote her former music teacher, "I seem to have no anxiety about leading a life of single blessedness. but she mentioned Rockefeller and said that a gentleman told me not long ago that he was in no particular rush to have me get married, but he hoped that in the multitude of my thoughts I would not forget the subject. She must have been torn when contemplating a match with Rockefeller, for teachers had to remain single and marriage would end her career. In 1862, Rockefeller, buoyed by his rising wealth in the produce business, began to woo Setty in earnest, often appearing at her school at day's end to take her home. The Spellmans then lived in a lovely area of apple groves and greenery called the Heights, and on weekends John and Brother William often rode out there under the guise of watching Civil War recruits drill nearby. After the Spellmans moved to a new home in downtown Cleveland, John, often wearing boots spattered with oil from his new refinery, stopped by and took Setty out for drives in his buckboard, and she heard with delight the details of his business. "Her judgment was always better than mine," Rockefeller said. "She was a woman of great sagacity. Without her keen advice, I would be a poor man." There was loving exaggeration here, but in the early days of their marriage, she did bring home the books and review them with her. Despite her constant reluctance, Rockefeller pursued her with quiet persistence. In love, as in business, he had a longer time frame, a more settled will, than other people. By early 1864, with the first profits rolling in from refining, he had become a substantial person in Cleveland, cutting an impressive figure in his frock coat, silk hat, and striped trousers. He was a handsome young man with a fine straight nose, rather humorless mouth, and vaguely mournful visage. His mustache flowed into fluffy side whiskers, but his hair was already receding at the temples. His eyes were steady and lucid, as if confidently scanning the horizon for business opportunities. Later on, Rockefeller was peculiarly reluctant to divulge to his children details of his courtship, referring to the delicacy of the situation. One gathers that another man, more practiced in the arts of love, was after Laura, and that by March 1864, John feared his rival might best him. The time had come to force the situation. As one person who heard the story secondhand remembered, John D. wanted to marry her, so he went to her one day and proposed in a businesslike way, just like he would make a business proposition. She accepted him in the same businesslike way. One imagines the two of them smiling shyly with relief. Shortly afterward, the ascetic Rockefeller did something wholly out of character, spending a shocking $118 for a diamond engagement ring. The splurge, one suspects, had a point. He wished to telegraph to the Spellmans that he was no longer a callow country boy, but a rising young businessman who could support them in a style to which they were accustomed. After a discreet 6-month engagement, on September 8, 1864, hard on the heels of Sherman's march into Atlanta, John D. Rockefeller, 25, married Laura Celestia Spellman, 24, in the living room of the Spellman House on Huron Street. It was a small private affair attended only by the two families. Like many things in Rockefeller's life, it was carried out in secrecy, and the Cleveland papers printed no notice of it. Very odd, given the Spellman's prominence. It is unlikely that Big Bill attended, and John might have worried that his absence would spark curiosity about him. Having established his financial wherewithal, Rockefeller now reverted to type and spent just $15.75 on the wedding ring, which was duly recorded in Ledger B under the rubric Sundry Expenses. In a denominational compromise, the pastors from Laura's Plymouth Congregational Church and John's Erie Street Baptist Mission Church jointly officiated, though Laura henceforth switched her allegiance to the Baptists. Refusing to deviate from routine, John worked the morning of his wedding day, visiting both his downtown office and the cooperage at the refinery. He had arranged a special luncheon for 26 employees, without disclosing at first the reason for the celebration. When the jovial bridegroom left for the wedding, he told the foreman facetiously, "Treat them well, but see that they work." With the Swiss precision that governed his life, Rockefeller allotted exactly 1 month, September 8th to October 8th, 1864, for a honeymoon that traced a conventional itinerary. The newlyweds started off at Niagara Falls, followed by a stay at the St. Lawrence Hall Hotel in Montreal, and the Summit House in Mount Washington, New Hampshire. On the way home, they stopped off at Oread Collegiate Institute and met two new teachers, Sophia B. Packard and Harriet E. Giles, who would play important roles in their future. Prior to his honeymoon, Rockefeller's travels had been limited, and the provincial young man in the tall silk hat exhibited voracious curiosity throughout the trip. While touring Niagara Falls, he peppered the guide with so many questions that the man grew distracted, ran the buggy into a ditch, and smashed a wheel. At another point, they met an old man in the roadway whom John so sedulously drained of local lore that the latter finally pleaded with weary resignation, "For God's sake, if you will go with me over to that barn yonder, I will start and tell you everything I ever knew." This was the same monotonously inquisitive young man who was known as the Sponge in the oil regions. For the first 6 months of their marriage, John and Laura lived with Eliza at 33 Cheshire Street. Then they moved into a dignified two-story brick house at 29 Cheshire Street. Surrounded by a white picket fence, the house had tall, graceful windows, but was disfigured by an ugly portico. Even though Rockefeller now operated and partially owned the largest refinery in Cleveland, he and Laura lived frugally without house servants. Rockefeller always cherished the chaste simplicity of this early period and preserved their first set of dishes, which stirred him to wistful reflections in later years. Thus, by the end of the Civil War, John D. Rockefeller had established the foundations of his personal and professional life and was set to capitalize on the extraordinary opportunities beckoning him in post-war America. From this point forward, there would be no zigzags or squandered energy, only a single-minded focus on objectives that would make him both the wonder and terror of American business. Chapter 6. The Poetry of the Age. The period after the Civil War was the most fertile in American history for schemers and dreamers, sharp-elbowed men and fast-talking hucksters, charlatans and swindlers. A perfect mania for patents and inventions swept America as everybody tinkered with some new contrivance. It was a time of bombastic rhetoric and outsized dreams. As always, during a protracted war, millions of people postponed their lives until the ghastly bloodshed was over. Then they turned to private life with newfound zeal. The sudden wealth of young businessmen such as Rockefeller fed envy among returning soldiers who wished to emulate their good fortune. The money fever was, in part, the reaction to a war that had appealed to both the worst and the best in the national character. For Lincoln's high-minded crusade had often been debased by profiteering contractors operating behind patriotic facades. For many in the North, the high drama of preserving the Union and emancipating the slaves had exhausted their capacity for altruism, leaving a residual contagion of greed. As the banker Thomas Mellon observed of these years of unfettered growth, "It was such a period as seldom occurs, and hardly ever more than once in anyone's lifetime. The period between 1863 and 1873 was one in which it was easy to grow rich. There was a steady increase in the value of property and commodities, and an active market all the time. One had only to buy anything and wait to sell at a profit. Sometimes, as in real estate, for instance, at a very large profit in a short time." A new cult of opportunity sprang up, producing a generation of business leaders for whom work was the greatest adventure life afforded. As Mark Twain and Charles Dudley Warner wrote in The Gilded Age, "To the young American, the paths to fortune are innumerable and all open. There is invitation in the air and success in all his wide horizon." Or, as one character in William Dean Howells's novel The Rise of Silas Lapham phrased it, "There's no doubt but money is to the fore now. It is the romance, the poetry of our age." Self-made businessmen were the new demigods, and a copious self-help literature sermonized that young men who worked hard and saved could enter the millionaire's pantheon. This new industrial boom downgraded the power of the old gentry and rural elites, substituting a new species of self-made men. economic marauders too busy making money to be overly concerned with tradition. The era of the Great Barbecue, the felicitous name coined by literary historian Vernon Parrington, was dominated by arrogant, enterprising men in railroads, shipping, and stock manipulation. Jay Cook, Commodore Vanderbilt, Jay Gould, Daniel Drew, Jim Fisk, and many others. The age was presided over by an inept president, General Ulysses S. Grant, a small-town businessman before the war who was enamored of the rich, no matter how frequently they tried to fleece him. The public was divided about these colossal developments. The appetite for gain fostered new fortunes and built up the industrial infrastructure, setting the stage for American industrial prominence, but it also unsettled people with a sense of something frightening, gigantic, and poorly understood that was drastically transforming their innocent country. The Civil War invited people to repudiate their pasts as they staked out new lives. As Grant phrased it in his memoirs, "The war begot a spirit of independence and enterprise. The feeling now is that a youth must cut loose from his old surroundings to enable him to get up in the world." As people took unethical shortcuts to success, the universal race for riches threatened to overthrow existing moral systems and subvert the authority of church and state. The triumph of the North meant the ascendancy of urbanization, immigration, industrial capitalism, and wage labor over an agrarian southern economy doomed to stagnate for decades. The war markedly accelerated the timetable of economic development, promoting the growth of factories, mills, and railroads. By stimulating technological innovation and standardized products, it ushered in a more regimented economy. The world of small farmers and businessmen began to fade, upstaged by a gargantuan new world of mass consumption and production. As railroad expansion gained momentum, populating the West and culminating in completion of the first transcontinental railroad in 1869, it spawned an accompanying mania in land deals, stock promotions, and mining developments. People rushed to exploit millions of acres of natural resources that could be economically brought to market for the first time. In short, by the end of the Civil War, the preconditions existed for an industrial economy of spectacular new proportions. Before the war, the federal government had only 20,000 employees and shied away from attempts to regulate business. Unlike Europe, America had no tradition of political absolutism or ecclesiastic privilege to quench entrepreneurial spirits, and the weak, fragmented political system gave businessmen room to flourish. At the same time, America had the legal and administrative apparatus necessary to support modern industry. There was respect for private property and contracts. People could get limited corporate charters or file for bankruptcy. And bank credit, while not yet plentiful, was everywhere available in a highly fragmented banking system. In time, the government redefined the rules of the capitalist game to tame trusts and preserve competition. But as John D. Rockefeller set about building his fortune, the absence of clear-cut rules probably aided, at first, the creative vigor of the new industrial economy. Perhaps no industry so beguiled the Civil War veterans with promises of overnight wealth than the oil industry. In astonishing numbers, a ragtag group of demobilized soldiers, many still in uniform and carrying knapsacks and rifles, migrated to northwest Pennsylvania. The potential money to be made was irresistible, whether in drilling or in auxiliary services. People could charge two or three times as much as they dared to ask in the city. Ida Tarbell speculated that this little corner of Pennsylvania absorbed a larger portion of men probably than any other spot in the United States. There were lieutenants and captains and majors, even generals, scattered all over the field. They brought with them a military sense of organization and a bellicose competitive spirit, but they were eager for quick killings and betrayed little sense of how to fashion a stable, lasting business, providing an opening for the organization-minded Rockefeller. The war had stimulated growth in the use of kerosene by cutting off the supply of southern turpentine, which had yielded a rival illuminant called camphene. The war had also disrupted the whaling industry and led to a doubling of whale oil prices. Moving into the vacuum, kerosene emerged as an economic staple and was primed for a furious post-war boom. This burning fluid extended the day in cities and removed much of the lonely darkness from rural life. The petroleum industry also furnished lubricants to grease the wheels of heavy industry. Though the world oil industry was squeezed into western Pennsylvania, the repercussions were felt everywhere. In 1865, Congressman James Garfield alluded to the oil craze in a letter to a former staff officer. "I have conversed on the general question of oil with a number of members who are in the business, for you know the fever has assailed Congress in no mild form. Oil, not cotton, is king now in the world of commerce." Soon, John D. Rockefeller would reign as the undisputed king of that world. In many ways, Rockefeller seemed a finely tuned instrument of the zeitgeist, the purest embodiment of the dynamic, acquisitive spirit of the post-war era. Like other Gilded Age moguls, he was shaped by his faith in economic progress, the beneficial application of science to industry, and America's destiny as an economic leader. He steeled himself to persevere, subordinating his every impulse to the profit motive, working to master unruly emotions, and striving for an almost Buddhist detachment from his own appetites and passions. "I had a bad temper," Rockefeller said. "I think it might be called an ugly temper when too far provoked." So he trained himself to control this temper and tried never to be guided by ego or pique. By the end of the Civil War, the pale, trim 26-year-old with the reddish-gold hair and side whiskers carried himself like a man of importance. No sooner had he formed a new firm with Sam Andrews than he was bent on expanding it. In December 1865, he and Andrews inaugurated a second refinery, the Standard Works, with Brother William appointed its nominal head. The combined Excelsior and Standard Works confirmed Rockefeller as the leading Cleveland refiner at a time when the city ranked among the top refining centers. Photos of his first refineries show an unprepossessing cluster of buildings, scarcely bigger than sheds, spaced irregularly across a hillside. With hands clasped behind his back, Rockefeller paced these works, poking his head in everywhere, a perfectionist alert to the tiniest details. When he saw somebody attending to a neglected, unswept corner, he smiled and said, "That's right, eternal vigilance." For foreman, he recruited a man named Ambrose McGregor, who was, in Rockefeller's description, a precise, exacting man, honest as the day, but perhaps not given to cultivating people. An imposing, bewhiskered figure, McGregor won Rockefeller's absolute trust on all technical matters. Since the refineries stood some distance from downtown, Rockefeller and McGregor often lunched at the boarding house of a Mrs. Jones. The two men in their oil-soaked boots regularly offended the nostrils of other diners and were exiled to the porch. As a self-made man in a new industry, Rockefeller wasn't stultified by precedent or tradition, which made it easier for him to innovate. He continued to value autonomy from outside suppliers. At first, he had paid small coopers up to $2.50 for white oak barrels, before he showed, in an early demonstration of economies of scale, that he could manufacture dry, tight casks more cheaply himself. Soon his firm made thousands of blue-painted barrels daily for less than a dollar per barrel. Other Cleveland coopers bought and shipped green timber to their shops, whereas Rockefeller had the oak sawed in the woods, then dried in kilns, reducing its weight and slicing transportation costs in half. And he continually extended the market for petroleum byproducts, selling benzene, paraffin, and petroleum jelly in addition to kerosene. In this early period, Rockefeller was a chronic warrior who labored under a great deal of self-imposed stress. Though not versed in the scientific side of refining, he often exercised a direct managerial role in the plant. With fluctuating market conditions, he sometimes needed to send shipments to New York with great dispatch, and personally rushed down to the railroad tracks to motivate his freight handlers. "I shall never forget how hungry I was in those days. I stayed out of doors day and night. I ran up and down the tops of freight cars when necessary. I hurried up the boys." At the time, refiners were tormented by fears that the vapors might catch fire, sparking an uncontrollable conflagration. Fire had already taken many lives in the industry. Edwin Drake's well, for example, was destroyed by fire in the autumn of 1859. During the Civil War, there were so many spectacularly destructive blazes along Oil Creek that producers posted signs warning smokers will be shot. Mark Hanna, who later managed President McKinley's campaign, recalled how one morning in 1867 he woke up and discovered that his Cleveland refinery had burned to the ground, wiping out his investment, and such fears kept refiners on tenterhooks around the clock. "I was always ready night and day for a fire alarm from the direction of our works," said Rockefeller. "Then proceeded a dark cloud of smoke from the area, and then we dashed madly to the scene of the action. So we kept ourselves like the firemen, with their horses and hose carts always ready for immediate action." Such was the perpetual fire menace posed by the new industry that refineries were soon banned within the Cleveland city limits, hastening the growth of Kingsbury Run. In those years, oil tanks weren't hemmed in earthen banks as they later were, so if a fire started, it quickly engulfed all neighboring tanks in a flaming inferno. Before the automobile, nobody knew what to do with the light fraction of crude oil known as gasoline, and many refiners, under cover of dark, let this waste product run into the river. "We used to burn it for fuel in distilling the oil," said Rockefeller, "and thousands and hundreds of thousands of barrels of it floated down the creeks and rivers, and the ground was saturated with it in the constant effort to get rid of it. The noxious runoff made the Cuyahoga River so flammable that if steamboat captains shoveled glowing coals overboard, the water erupted in flames. Each time a black cloud billowed up in the sky, people assumed another refinery had exploded, and kerosene prices soared." At least in retrospect, Rockefeller sounded philosophic about this omnipresent danger. "In those days, when the fire bell rang, we would all go to the refinery and help put it out. When the fire was burning, I would have my pencil out, making plans for the rebuilding of our works." Even the dread of fire paled beside recurrent worries that the Pennsylvania oil wells would dry up, with no substitute in sight. As Rockefeller noted, "It was here today and there tomorrow, and none of us knew with any certainty about the continuance of the supply, without which these investments were valueless." Already by the late 1860s, stern prophecies were issued about the industry's impending demise. There were two types of oilmen, those who thought the sudden boom an insubstantial mirage and who cashed in their profits as soon as possible, and those, like Rockefeller, who saw petroleum as the basis of an enduring economic revolution. During the salutary nightly sermons he gave himself in bed, Rockefeller often meditated on the transience of earthly wealth, especially oil, and admonished himself, "You've got a fair fortune, you have a good property, now, but suppose the oil fields gave out?" Yet the future of the oil business became an article of religious faith for him, as did the feeling that the Lord had blessed him and his enterprise. In late 1867, several days before Christmas, he just missed a train that ended up in a terrible wreck, killing many passengers. And Rockefeller at once wrote to SETI, "I do, and did when I learned that the first train left, regard the thing as the providence of God." Not yet the bête noire of oil producers, Rockefeller frequently donned his shabby oil suit and traveled to Franklin, Pennsylvania, where he kept an office that purchased oil, saving on the cost of middlemen. The oil fever was so infectious in the oil regions that these trips always silenced any fugitive doubts he might have entertained about the industry's survival. As one traveler reported after visiting Oil Creek in 1866, "Men think of oil, talk of oil, dream of oil. The smell and taste of oil predominate in all they eat and drink." These trips energized Rockefeller, who returned to Cleveland with renewed faith. As a friend recalled, "When he came back, he would always have great tales to tell, and his eyes would snap as he would speak of his desires to succeed." In the 1860s, nobody knew if significant oil deposits existed outside the rugged terrain of northwest Pennsylvania, so the industry had immediately taken on global proportions. Within a year of Drake's discovery, his backers were marketing oil in London and Paris, and Europe emerged rapidly as the foremost market for American kerosene, importing hundreds of thousands of barrels yearly during the Civil War. Perhaps no other American industry had such an export outlook from its inception. By 1866, fully two-thirds of Cleveland kerosene was flowing overseas, most of it routed through New York, which became the export entrepot for oil. At once, Rockefeller saw that he had to look beyond American shores to soak up excess production. It seemed absolutely necessary to extend the market for oil by exporting to foreign countries, which required a large and most difficult development. To accomplish this, he dispatched Brother William to New York City in 1866 to launch the firm of Rockefeller and Company, which would oversee the exports of their Cleveland refineries. If William wasn't much younger than John, "My brother is 1 year, 1 month, and 8 days younger than I am," John specified with comic exactitude. He certainly had a younger brother's deference and mentality. Already settled by this time, William had gotten married in May 1864 to Myra Geraldine Goodsell, who came from a well-heeled Cleveland family with Yankee antecedents. The photos of William in his early 20s reveal a young man with thick mutton chop whiskers, clear eyes, and a broad, smooth forehead, who looks more placid and less driven than his elder brother. Throughout their lives, despite their antithetical temperaments, William was bluff and friendly and freer than John in morals and manners. The brothers remained warm companions and close colleagues. William was a natural salesman who easily charmed people. Even in Pennsylvania, he was a popular figure who swapped tales with oil producers while John held himself aloof. "William always judges everything by intuition and instinct," said John, tacitly contrasting his brother with himself. "He doesn't act on analysis." But those instincts were sound, and while William took things seriously, he didn't puff them up into grand moral crusades the way his brother did. As a novice businessman, William had been precocious like his brother. After joining John as a bookkeeper at Hewitt and Tuttle, he was spirited away by a local miller and ended up at a produce commission house, making partner after just 1 year. By age 20, he was already earning $1,000 a year. "Much more than I got," noted John wryly, and winning his older brother's confidence. "My brother was a young, active, and efficient, and successful businessman." The quality that most endeared William to John was sheer dependability. In later years, John repeated the anecdote of how his brother, as a young bookkeeper, awoke in the night and realized that he had made an error in a bill of lading. He was so disturbed that he couldn't wait till morning to correct it, and marched down to the lakefront warehouse during the night so that the ship could sail on time with proper paperwork. In September 1865, William left the produce house of Hughes, Davis, and Rockefeller to join his brother's oil refining business, and when the Standard Works was organized that December, it bore the name of William Rockefeller and Company. Before long, John D. Rockefeller was cast by critics as the omnipotent wizard of the oil market, setting prices as the whim seized him. But by sending William to New York, he acknowledged that the export market decisively influenced oil prices. Whenever news of a Pennsylvania gusher reached New York, the French and German buyers, anticipating lower prices, simply stopped buying, and this made them the ultimate arbiters of price. "They sat there like a lot of vultures," said Rockefeller. "They wouldn't buy until the price of refined had fallen very low on account of the flood of crude oil in the market." One of William's tasks in New York was to apprise the firm's buyers in the oil regions of sudden drops in export prices, so that they could temporarily curtail crude oil purchases. When William arrived in New York, he set up unadorned offices at 181 Pearl Street, and the proximity to Wall Street was critical. To implement their audacious schemes, the Rockefellers needed massive capital, but encountered two problems that seemed insuperable. The elite Wall Street bankers preferred to finance railroads and government and regarded oil refining as a risky, untested business, nothing short of outright gambling. Mindful of the extreme fire hazards and the specter of the oil running dry, only a few intrepid souls dared to wager on it. At the same time, John D.'s insatiable need for money outstripped the meager resources of Cleveland banks, forcing him to widen his search to New York, where he could secure credit at more advantageous rates. And my dear brother William, being located in the metropolis, where the opportunities were better for securing money, had upon him this financial burden, and he showed marked ability in keeping a steady nerve and presenting our case very well to the bankers. As a result of John's foresight in assigning him to New York, William's career became closely intertwined with that of Wall Street, to an uncomfortable extent from John's later perspective. As a gray eminence in the business world in his retirement, John D. betrayed a deep suspicion of financiers, boasted that he never borrowed, and was celebrated for his financial conservatism. Yet at this stage of his career, he turned inescapably to bankers. One can hardly recognize how difficult it was to get capital for active business enterprises at that time, he admitted. If Rockefeller ever came close to grovel,